Welcome to another Salvation by Grace Sunday morning message from Grace Christian Assembly. We are currently engaged in a verse-by-verse exposition of the book of Hebrews. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
Turn, no surprise, to Hebrews 11. We won't be there for long, but we are going to start there. Let me just say yet again how much I like GCA. You know that I have wanted for a long time to be able to build an extension on our building or a separate worship room over here. I have wanted for a long time to build a room a little more conducive to all the people that are in the room right now. It gets a little crowded, it gets a little tight, and so I've been wanting for a long time to expand. But it would cost us a minimum of about $300,000, and we just don't have that money. I don't know where God's going to get the money from, but he's done it before. I can assume he can do it again, and that he'll do it in his own good time. And so once in a while, I get that in my head where I start thinking, I want building, and I start putting the emphasis on building. And I drive around town and I see some of the other churches, and I know that what they're teaching is not, let's just say, not as biblical as I would like it to be, not quite as substantial as I would prefer, and yet they have these wonderful buildings. And it just irks me because I want a building. And then recently I had a conversation with a fellow who's a part of a church in a big building. Big building. And he told me that their church was struggling. And I hear this so often from pastors because I talk to pastors and I move in circles of pastors and I hear them talk about their congregations and the difficulties and the politics and the infighting and the backstabbing and the people jockeying for position and the power plays and all the stuff that goes on in churches. And I'm always happy to be able to say to them, I think in our 12 years as a public church, I can only think of one event that even sort of smacked of that. We've been remarkably fortunate in all these years that we've been able to continue getting together as a body of believers and that we've been able to worship together and that there haven't been splits or schisms. There's no other group up the road that used to be GCA that finally said, that's it, we're going with Tom, you know, and went up the road. And the Tomites have not yet completely broken off from us. And we're just very, very fortunate that that's the way it is. So I had like a readjustment in my thinking over the weekend, because for the last few weeks I've been seeing some of the construction that's going on here in town, some of the other local churches that are growing and building, and I keep thinking, we need to build. We've got too many people in this little room. We need to be able to extend it so that there's not folks sitting out in the foyer as there is this morning. We need to be able to do something about that, but I'll tell you this, I wouldn't trade, because when I hear about some of those other congregations and the things they go through and the fights and the politics and the backstabbing and the stuff, I'll take this group of people in this little room any day of the week and twice on Sunday. Well, we don't meet twice on Sunday. But I would take this every time over some of the comments and some of the things I hear about some of these churches that have big buildings but just have no cohesion, no life in the body. There's not the same sense of fellowship as we have here. So I love you all. And when I say I love you all, I mean I love you all. I love you, man. Because I was telling Tim and I had lunch on Friday. And I said, you know, when this all began, I liked being the teacher. Teacher gig was good with me. I liked especially traveling and teaching. That was a good thing I got to do. But I never wanted to be pastor. That just wasn't a job that enticed me. Because pastor means to get down in the trenches with people and deal with their stuff. And that stuff is not always attractive stuff. It's sometimes difficult stuff. It's sometimes emotional stuff, and I'm not the kind of person, I'm much too egocentric to want to carry your burden for you. And so I never really wanted to be a pastor. But over time, God has broken that part of my will and has taught me through interaction with people like Elder Ward, who was just absolutely essential to my development as a pastor. And I have learned the hard way how to give myself away and how to be a pastor. So I'm just saying all that to say, as congregations go, for a guy who pastors for a living, you're just so good to me that I really, really appreciate you all, and I really love you tremendously. And these days when the phone rings and it's one of you all, I'm happy. I'm happy every time I get to pick up the phone and it's one of you all. Even when you're calling to say, I have a situation, or I have a problem, or can you pray for me? Can you answer a question? I'm always happy to hear from you. So I really love you, and I want to say that yet again. I've had my thinking and my mind readjusted yet again to learn to appreciate all the good things that I do have instead of spending time whining about what I don't have. Someday, if God wants us to have a bigger building, we'll have a bigger building. But in the meantime, we have this. And I know churches that don't have this. So I'm very, very grateful for it. And I'm very grateful to you all, collectively and individually. And I want to make sure and say that. All right? We're in Hebrews 11. Let's start in verse 17, because starting in verse 17 through verse 22, the writer of Hebrews is concentrating on the particular heroes of faith who he has picked out of the book of Genesis. Then he's going to get to Moses and move into Exodus, but he's concentrating at this moment on those that are referred to as the forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. And what's particularly important about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, he has already told us, is that they are the three who specifically received the land promise. The Abrahamic covenant was formed with Abraham, with Isaac, with Jacob. And so he's been very specific in pointing out those particular people to the exclusion of Ishmael. In Isaac shall thy seed be called. And now in verse 19, he's going to address the next person in that lineage of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He's going to talk about Jacob. And of course, you know that Jacob is the person who had his name changed eventually to Israel. So whenever we speak of Israel, we're talking about the descendants of Jacob, who is the progenitor of all Israel. We'll talk about that name a little bit more later in the morning. So starting at verse 17, he said, by faith Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises was offering up his only begotten son, to whom it was said, in Isaac shall your descendants or your seed be called. And we read that last week, because he considered that God was able to raise up men even from the dead, from which he also received his son back. The New American Standard says as a type, and I told you it's the word from which we get in a parable. Then in verse 20, he says, by faith Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau, and then this very interesting phrase, regarding things to come. So in other words, he's now going to prove to us that Isaac had his sons, and he blessed his sons. He spoke prophetically over his sons, and that he did that by faith. And this is one of the most fascinating stories anywhere in the Old Testament. It's one of the most interesting stories in the book of Genesis, and it's interesting on so many different levels. So we're going to spend the whole morning talking about Jacob and Esau. Now, anytime you say Jacob and Esau, of course, you instantaneously want to add, Jacob have I loved and Esau have I hated, because that is the most infamous verse about Jacob and Esau that you find in the Bible. It's repeated, of course, by Paul when he's in Romans 9 and he's talking about God's election. He speaks of Jacob and Esau and says that they were two twins in a womb, hadn't done any good, hadn't done any evil, and yet God said, Jacob have I loved and Esau have I hated. And then Paul adds, so that God's election by grace would stand. So in the story of Jacob and Esau, Paul found the foundation for the doctrine of sovereign election. Therefore, when we say things like sovereign election, when we talk about God predestining particular people to salvation and that he elects and chooses those people, when we say that stuff, if you say that publicly or in a religious atmosphere or in the church world, they will point at you and say, well, you're a Calvinist. I saw a note just this morning. I couldn't help but chuckle about it, a Facebook note this morning from one of our listeners online who said that once she had come to realize that Ephesians 1 was all about the glory of God's grace, she was in a Sunday school class and they were talking about picking and choosing God, making Jesus Lord and Savior. And she said, But have you read in Ephesians 2 where it says that we're dead in our trespasses and sins? And apparently the person leading the class argued with her and said, no, that means, you know, if you don't choose Jesus, then you're going to be dead in your trespasses and sins. She said, no, that's not what it says. It says you are. That's what you are by nature. You're dead in your trespasses and sins. And he responded, well, you read it that way because you're a Calvinist. And that's the way it's always thrown back at us. When we say, Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated, so that the election of grace will stand, people say, well, you read that because you're a Calvinist. That's why you read it that way. But we're just saying what Paul said, and the important thing is, Paul didn't say that because he was a Calvinist. Paul said that because he read the Old Testament. Now, by the way, when you go back to the book of Genesis, you're going to discover that the phrase, Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated, is not in Genesis. It's not in the original story of Jacob and Esau that we're going to look at this morning. In fact, that phrase doesn't show up until the very last book of the Old Testament, the book of Malachi. So turn there. Go to the Old Testament very last book. In other words, go to Matthew 1:1 and turn back, and you'll be there. Very first chapter of the book of Malachi, one person enjoyed my Matthew joke. One. Malachi the prophet is castigating Israel. God is not happy with Israel in this book. This is the book in which he says, you have robbed me. And they say, wherein have we robbed you? You've robbed me in tithes and offerings. Bring all your tithes into the storehouse so that there may be meat in my house. God is not happy with Israel. They have not been doing the things God has told them to do. And so God is contending with them, and the book opens with the oracle of the word of the Lord to Israel through Malachi. I have loved you, says the Lord, but you say, how have you loved us? Here's God's answer. To prove that he has loved Israel. Was not Esau Jacob's brother, declares the Lord? Yet I have loved Jacob, but I have hated Esau. And I have made his mountains a desolation and appointed his inheritance for the jackals of the wilderness. Though Edom says, Edom, by the way, is a synonymous word for Esau, the Edomites are the descendants of Esau. Though Edom says, we have been beaten down, but we will return and build up the ruins. Thus says the Lord of hosts, they may build, but I will tear down. And men will call them the wicked territory and the people toward whom the Lord is indignant forever. So here's God's contention with Israel. He says, I've loved you. And they say, where? Where is this love you speak about? And he reaches all the way back to the two babies in the womb. And says, Jacob, who you are the descendants of, you Israelites are descendants of Jacob. Jacob's going to have his name changed to Israel. I have loved you and I have hated Esau. And then he gives them his evidence and says, look what I've done to the Edomites. You know what I've done to them. You know the way that I have torn down their territories and scattered them. You know that I hate them. And you can tell by the history of my dealing with them that I hate them. So he says, Jacob I've loved, Esau I've hated, there's the evidence that I have loved you. And that's why through the whole rest of this book, he keeps saying, why haven't you loved me back? Why haven't you done the things that I told you to do? That's the entire polemic. And it begins with I've loved you and I've hated Esau. Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated. And so Paul, of course, picks that up, as I said, in Romans 9, and uses that as the basis to say why. Why did God choose Jacob and reject Esau? Why did he love one and hate the other when they're just two babies in the womb? And the only answer Paul could come up with was election. It's sovereign election. It's just God choosing. It's just God picking. Anybody in this room, you don't have to answer, don't raise your hand. Anybody in this room have family members who you are close with, that you grew up with, and you look at them today and you say, boy, they seem like they're a long way away from God. And yet you can see in yourself that, well, you're here this morning. And you care about the things of God, and you study the Bible, and you think about these things, and you muse on the things of God, and you meditate on His Word. What's the difference between you and them? Family, same household, same parents. And yet, for some reason, you care about the things of God, and they just don't. Is it because you were better? Smarter? Run faster, jump higher? Speed, skill, agility, perfect timing, constant practice, along with that never give up attitude. Is that really what did it for you? No. Obviously, the answer is always sovereign election. God chose you. And throughout the Bible, He says, especially when speaking to Israel, I didn't choose you because you were the good ones. He says, and I didn't choose you because you were the greatest in number. Indeed, you're a small group of people. And you can see that He chose people that He knew were going to be rebellious. For goodness sake, Jacob, the name, means heel catcher, supplanter. It means trickster. His own name tells you what his character is. And that's the one God loved. Well, this is very good news if you're anything like me or Tom. Okay, so turn back to Genesis now. Turn to Genesis 25. Let's start there. Genesis 25, we're going to start around verse 19. No, we're going to start right at verse 19. By hope. She was just amening. That's all she was doing. She was just totally with me the whole time. See? See what I'm saying? She's totally with me. All right, we're starting in chapter 25 of the book of Genesis. We are at verse 19. This is the story of Jacob and Esau, one of the most fascinating stories you're going to find anywhere in the Old Testament. Get to know this story, because God is going to be very specific about this one, the younger one, the second one, is going to rule over his brother, and that's going to happen through chicanery and deceit and a wife conspiring with her son to trick the husband to give him the blessing. In other words, sinful people are going to do what their sinful minds want a sinful do. And they're going to do exactly what God in advance said was going to be the outcome. Because our God is sovereign. Verse 19. Now these are the records of the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham became the father of Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean of Padan Aram, the sister of Laban, the Aramean, to be his wife. And Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was barren, and the Lord answered him, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. But the children, two of them, struggled together within her. And she said, if it is so, why then am I this way or like this? So she went to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb. Isn't that fascinating? It's two babies. And he says, in advance, knowing full well, sovereignly decrees, out of the two of them, I'm going to make two nations. The Israelites and the Edomites are going to come out of you. And they're going to fight with each other for the length of time between now and when Jesus comes back. By the way, they're still over there fighting. They're still over there to this very day arguing about the land of promise. The Bible's very relevant. I keep saying you cannot understand world geopolitics if you don't understand your Bible. It doesn't matter how many times they get together in Washington, how many times they powwow at the White House, how many times they get in front of the cameras out there in the garden at the White House. It doesn't matter how many peace pacts they make. How many have there been? There have been plenty of peace pacts, and each successive president has had to deal with the Middle East problem in trying to bring peace to the Middle East. And they just can't seem to strike a deal that actually works. Why? Because this problem is built in all the way back here. There are two kingdoms, two people groups, two nations in your womb, and they're already fighting in the womb, and they're going to continue that fight. Two peoples shall be separated from your body, and the one people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. So when her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. Now the first came out red all over like a hairy garment. And so they named him Esau, which essentially means hairy and red. He's a hairy red guy. Aren't you glad that people have stopped naming kids that way? The first came forth red all over like a hairy garment, and they named him Esau. And afterward, his brother came forth with his hand holding on to Esau's heel. In other words, he was a heel catcher. And so they named him Heel Catcher, which is what Yaakov means. Jacob is the anglicized version of Yaakov. And he came out clutching Esau's heel, so his name was Jacob, heel catcher, supplanter, tried to supplant his brother, tried to get out ahead of his brother. And Isaac was 60 years old when his wife gave birth to the two of them. When the boys grew up, Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the field, but Jacob was a peaceful man living in tents. Now Isaac loved Esau because he had a taste for game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Now, Rebekah is the one who heard from God that the younger was going to be the superior one. The older was going to serve the younger. And so she favored the younger. She also probably favored him because he was a peaceful man who lived in tents, whereas her older son was a hunter and out there in the fields. Dad liked the hunter because he liked the food that his son would bring back for him. So now Isaac loved Esau because he had a taste for game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. And when Jacob had cooked stew, the King James has a mess of pottage, which I think is an interesting phrase. It's basically just some kind of a lentil soup, a stew that he had cooked for himself, and he's out there eating it in the field. Esau came in from the field, and he was famished. He was very hungry. Esau said to Jacob, "Please let me have a taste or a swallow of that red stuff there, the red lentil soup, for I am famished." Therefore his name shall be called Edom. But Jacob said, "First sell me your birthright." Can I think about this for a moment? He's been out in the field. He comes in. He's hungry. He's so hungry, he claims, he's famished. I'm starving. Anybody ever use that word? I'm starving. You point at all the kids. They come into the kitchen. "Mom, I'm starving. I haven't eaten in 2, maybe 3 hours. I'm starving." Well, he's been out in the field. He comes in, and there's no mention of him having any game with him, any animals with him. We don't really know if he had any food with him. He comes in. He says, "I'm just starving. I'm so hungry. You seem to have some already cooked food. I don't want to go through the trouble of cooking, preparing, doing all that. Just give me something to eat." And his younger brother, the heel catcher, the supplanter, true to his name, true to his character, says, "Sure, I'll take advantage of this situation. You're really, really hungry. You're the oldest. You have the birthright. Give me your birthright," which means give me the inheritance of our father. Everything that our father has collected in his life, all of his servants and his household, his land, his holdings, everything that belongs to our father, give it to me, and I'll give you some Campbell's cream of mushroom soup. just so you understand the comparison, it's just a mess of pottage. It's just a stew. First sell me your birthright. And Esau said, behold, I am about to die. I am about to die. So of what use then is the birthright to me? I mean, if I die, it doesn't matter if I have the birthright or not. You're going to inherit it because I'm going to be dead. So what difference does it make? I'll go ahead and give you the birthright. So Jacob said, first swear to me. So he swore to him, and he sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went on his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. The writer of Hebrews is going to pick it up and say, not to be profane, like that profane person Esau. Isn't that interesting? Because when we think of the word profane, when we think of profanity, we usually think of dirty words. And I'm certainly not advocating for the use of filthy language. Even Paul says not to use filthy language. But Esau giving up the birthright that he would be inheriting, this is the way that the property of a man would be handed down. It would go to the firstborn. And then, of course, God would always say, but it's going to go to the younger, and it's going to go to the younger, showing that he could sovereignly decide and elect as he pleased to give it to whomever he pleased. But the standard, the rule was the birthright, the inheritance, importantly, that belonged first to Abraham and now belonged to Isaac, the inheritance of the land itself, the whole total picture of everything that is encased in the Abrahamic covenant is the birthright that at that moment belonged to Esau, and he gave it all up for some soup. That's a real profanity, because he did not cherish holy things. And to not cherish and love holy righteous things is profane. So he sold his soup. Turn forward to... Yes. Doesn't immediate gratification absolutely define our whole culture? Sure. And that is profane. Yeah. Especially if it's immediate gratification when compared to waiting on the Lord, trusting in God to provide. If I was going to extrapolate on that, and now I will, thanks. I was trying to just kind of move forward. But if in fact life and death is in God's hands, was Esau really going to die before he got home? I mean, he's at his brother's land, at least. Remember, his brother dwelt in tents. He'd made it as far as his brother's. But his own estimation of his own estate was, I am so hungry. I'm just so hungry, I just have to eat something. And rather than trust that God would keep him alive, and rather than trust that God's covenant with Abraham and Isaac that would be passed down to him was valuable, he was willing to trade it away in exchange for something to eat. And yes, in an instant gratification society like what we live in today, people are perfectly willing to throw away the things of God in favor of what I can get here and now. Your best life now would be a pretty good example. And so, because there is a movement within Christianity that recognizes the instant gratification desire within human beings, they have created and are promulgating a theology based on instant gratification because it sells. And so there is this entire undercurrent within modern evangelicalism of substandard, sub-biblical theology that makes it all about you and gratifying yourself, and God wants you to be happy and wealthy and wise. You get whatever you want whenever you want it. And that sells, and it brings in money, and it builds big buildings and brings more people in, and it's all based on you get what you want whenever you want it, get it now. Don't worry about waiting on God. Don't worry about faith in God. Don't worry about God being your sustenance and your provision. Go get what you want now. That's what God wants for you. And it's profane theology. Yeah?
Yes.
There's a lot of people nodding in the room. All right, I'm in chapter 27. Turn there. We're going to continue the story. It's a very good comment. Thank you, Mary Jane, for clicking that part of my brain.
I know it's not part of the introduction, so we're safe.
So we're safe, exactly. So we're good. I'm on the clock, so it's good. So now at this point, Esau has sold his birthright to his brother Jacob. However, the parents are not in on the deal. Only Jacob and Esau know about the deal. The final birthright comes through an act of blessing from the father. Isaac is going to have to actually bring Esau into the room, put his hands on Esau's head, and confer upon him the right of the firstborn. This still has to be done. And so even though Esau said to his brother, "I'm going to sell you my birthright," if Esau happens to be in the room at the moment that his father confers that blessing, it still transfers to Esau. So for all we know, Esau was still expecting to get it. And in fact, when you hear the way that Esau cries to his father later, you get the impression that Esau did still expect to get it. So he may have even been lying to his brother when his brother said, "Swear to me, swear to me." And he said, "Okay, I swear." Okay, having sworn, having given away his birthright, now it actually has to come to fruition. Isaac has to actually put his hands on the head of his younger son and confer the birthright blessing in order for this all to come true. Now that's got to happen, especially because God has already said that the older is going to serve the younger. So the younger is going to get the birthright blessing somehow. How is he going to get it, though? Because, remember, Isaac prefers his older son. And he wants to give the birthright to his older son. The same way that Abraham wanted to give the birthright to Ishmael and even said to God, "Oh, that Ishmael may stay in front of me, be before me all the days of my life." And then, of course, God said, "No, in Isaac shall thy seed be called." So here again, God has chosen Jacob over Esau, but Isaac prefers Esau. And now the birthright blessing has to go to Jacob. How is this going to be accomplished? Through lying and chicanery. That's how it's going to be accomplished. His own wife is going to be in cahoots with his youngest son to deceive him because he's blind in order to bring about what God already said was going to happen. This is compatibilism at its finest. The theological concept of compatibilism is simply that the sinful will and desires of human beings are actually ultimately compatible with the sovereign will of God. I'll give you an example. The worst thing that ever happened on planet Earth was the killing of the only righteous one. Terrible thing. And men did it of their own will and desire and hatred of Christ. And yet, Peter said, Herod and Pilate and the Jews and the Gentiles were all gathered together to do whatsoever your hand predetermined to be done. So God foreordained the killing of Christ, and yet it was done by wicked men. Peter had no problem with saying, "You with wicked hands killed the Prince of Life and desired a murderer." So there's no question that their will was involved, their desire was involved, and they did exactly what they wanted to do. They wanted to kill Jesus, and they did. And in so doing, they accomplished the greatest thing that ever happened in the history of the world, the redemption of all God's people. He is so sovereign, he is able to work in and through depraved, wicked people in order to accomplish his ultimate outcome. The other example that I always use to prove God's compatibilism is the statement that Joseph made to his brothers when they finally stood before him, when he was second only to Pharaoh in Egypt. They, of course, beg for mercy when they realize that this is Joseph, their brother, who they threw in a pit and sold off as a slave and then convinced dad that Joseph is dead. Now they're standing in front of him and they're scared. And he says to them, "You meant it for evil." So there's no question what their intention was. They did all that with evil intent. But then he says, "But God meant it for good to bring about this present result that many are saved alive." In other words, you did what you did with evil intention, and God meant what you did for this ultimate good that came about now. So God works in and through the evil intention and evil hearts of human beings in order to bring about his ultimate sovereign determination. So here he has determined that the older is going to serve the younger. We read later and know from Malachi and from Paul that God, while they were in the womb, chose Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated. Ultimately, then, God was going to prove his love to Israel in the way that he responded to and loved Israel despite their rebellion, and proved his hatred for Esau in the way that he treated them as a people and as a nation, as the Edomites. And all of that was predetermined while the babies were in the womb. And now it's going to come to its fruition through chicanery and lying and deceit, because God is that compatible. Got it?
What a mighty God.
What a mighty God. That's all you can say. Chapter 27, verse 1. Now it came about when Isaac was old and his eyes were too dim to see, that he called his older son Esau and said to him, "My son," and he said, "Here I am." And Isaac said, "Behold, now I am old, and I do not know the day of my death. Now then, please take your gear, your quiver, and your bow, and go out to the field and hunt for game for me. And prepare a savory dish for me, such as I love, and bring it to me that I may eat, so that my soul may bless you before I die." So his intention is that he's going to give the birthright blessing to his son Esau. But he says, just before I do that, go kill something, cook it up for me, bring it back to me, I'll eat my favorite meal, and then I'll give you the blessing. So there's no indication, despite the agreement that was made out there between Jacob and Esau, there's no indication that Isaac knows anything about it. And he's preparing to bless his older son. Verse 5, Rebekah was listening while Isaac spoke to his son Esau. So when Esau went to the field to hunt for game to bring home, Rebekah said to her son Jacob, "Behold, I heard your father speak to your brother Esau, saying, 'Bring me some game and prepare a savory dish for me that I may eat and bless you in the presence of the Lord before my death. Now, therefore, my son, listen to me as I command you. Go now to the flock, bring me two choice kids from there, that I may prepare them as a savory dish for your father, such as he loves.'" So she knows the kind of food the old man likes. And she says, "Run out, get me two kids. I'll cook it up and prepare it in such a way he'll think it's what he's expecting from Esau. And since Esau's out there looking for an animal and he's hunting it and he's out there, you hurry up and do it. Bring me something right from the flock. Don't go far. We're going to move fast. Go now to the flock and bring me two choice kids from there that I may prepare them as a savory dish for your father, such as he loves. Then you shall bring it to your father that he may eat, so that he will bless you before his death." Why is she doing this? Why is she trying to trick her husband? Jacob is her favorite son, but remember, God said to her, the older is going to serve the younger. And so she wants to make sure the birthright goes that way. What'd you say? And for some reason, she seems to think God needs help working out the plan. Exactly. "You shall bring it to me." Verse 11. "And Jacob answered his mother Rebekah, saying, 'Behold, Esau, my brother, is a hairy man, and I'm a smooth man. Perhaps my father will reach out and feel me, and then I shall be a deceiver in his sight, and I shall bring upon myself a curse and not a blessing.' But his mother said to him, 'Your curse will be on me, my son. Only obey my voice and go and get those things for me.'" In other words, she says, if he's upset with you for the deception, I'll take the blame. You're covered. I'll tell him I put you up to it. Just do what I'm telling you to do. "Then Rebekah took the best garments of Esau, her elder son, which were with her in the house, and put them on Jacob, her younger son. And she put the skins of the kids on his hands and on the smooth part of his neck." In other words, because he wasn't a hairy man like his brother, and since she had a couple baby goats or little sheep that she cooked up, she took some of the wool of the skin, plastered it on the back of his hands, and gave him a hairy chest. Made him manly. Put some hair around his neck and chest, put some hair on the back of his hands. Now if Dad feels you, you're going to feel hairy. And you're wearing your brother's clothes, so you're going to smell like your brother. She then gave him the savory food and the bread which she had made, and she gave it to her son Jacob. Verse 18. "Then he came to his father and said, 'My father.' And he said, 'Here I am. Who are you, my son?' And Jacob said to his father, I'm Esau, your firstborn. I have done as you told me. Get up, please. Sit and eat my game, that you may bless me. And Isaac said to his son, how is it that you have it so quickly, my son? Smart old man. He figured out, wait, I sent you out into the fields to kill some game, bring it back and cook it. How is it that you're already here with this? And listen to his answer. He said, because the Lord your God caused it to happen to me. He's now using God as his excuse.
The Lord your God didn't even claim it.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? The Lord your God. I barely walked into the field. Barely got out there. Boom, there's a deer. Deer falls over dead. I pick him up. He's already cooked. It was amazing. I brought it to you that quickly because the Lord your God caused it to happen to me. Then Isaac said to Jacob, please come close that I may feel you, my son, whether you are really my son Esau or not. He's already curious. Which means, by the way, I think, if you just kind of read between the lines a little bit, apparently he seems to know that his son is prone to this sort of chicanery. Perhaps his son, perhaps his wife. I mean, he's really cautious here.
He's seen it before.
He's seen it before somewhere that this is, this is all very coincidental. So Jacob came close to Isaac, his father, and he felt him and said, the voice is the voice of Jacob, but the hands are the hands of Esau. And he did not recognize him because his hands were hairy like his brother Esau's hands. So he blessed him. And he said, are you really my son Esau? And he said, I am. So he said, bring it to me and I will eat of my son's game that I may bless you. And he brought it to him and he ate, and he also brought him wine and he drank. And then his father Isaac said to him, please come close and kiss me, my son. So he came close and he kissed him. And when he smelled the smell of his garments, he blessed him. So even the kiss was to try to get a smell of his clothes and see if he smelled like Esau. And he said, see, the smell of my son is like the smell of the field which the Lord has blessed. Now may God give you of the dew of heaven and of the fatness of the earth and an abundance of grain and new wine. May peoples serve you and nations bow down to you. Be master of your brothers and may your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be those who curse you. Blessed be those who bless you. Well, there's the birthright blessing. He's just handed it over to the younger son and said that all the other brothers, all his mother's other sons, were going to bow down to him, which is exactly what God said when the two babies were in the womb, that the older was going to serve the younger. Now it came about as soon as Isaac had finished blessing Jacob, and Jacob had hardly gone out from the presence of Isaac his father, that Esau his brother came in from hunting. And then he also made savory food, and he brought it to his father. And he said to his father, let my father arise and eat of his son's game, that you may bless me. And Isaac his father said to him, who are you? And he said, I'm your son, your firstborn Esau. Then Isaac trembled violently and said, who was he then that hunted game and brought it to me so that I ate of all of it before you came and I blessed him? Yes, and he shall be blessed. In other words, there's no going back. There's no way to turn this around. I've already given him the birthright blessing and there's nothing we can do about it. And when Esau heard these words of his father, he cried out with an exceedingly great and bitter cry and said to his father, bless me, even me also, O my father. And he said, your brother came deceitfully, and he has taken away your blessing. Then he said, is he not rightly named supplanter? For he has supplanted me these two times. What would be the two times? Yeah, when he said, sell me your birthright. I'll give you some soup, you give me your birthright. You'll notice that Esau seemed to think that that deal didn't stick, because he's in there with his dad waiting to be blessed, thinking that he should get the birthright. He even says, it's me, Esau, I'm your firstborn. He's discounted the deal he made with his brother out there in the field. And now his brother, through chicanery with his mother, actually got the birthright blessing. And these are very important words. Esau says, well, then he's rightly named. because he is a supplanter, and he has supplanted me these two times. And he said, have you not reserved a blessing for me? Verse 37, but Isaac answered and said to Esau, behold, I have made him your master, and all his relatives I have given to him as servants, and with grain and new wine I have sustained him. Now as for you then, what can I do, my son? And Esau said to his father, do you have only one blessing, my father? Bless me, even me also, my father. So Esau lifted his voice, and he wept. And Isaac, his father, answered and said, behold, away from the fertility of the earth shall be your dwelling, and away from the dew of heaven from above. And by your sword you shall live, and your brother you shall serve. And it shall come about, when you become restless, that you shall break his yoke from your neck. So Esau bore a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And Esau said to himself, the days of mourning for my father are near, and then I will kill my brother Jacob. Now, interesting. Put the big picture together now that we've read all that. He blessed the younger. The younger was blessed in the womb by God. Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated. God chose the younger from the womb. But the point that the Hebrews writer is bringing out, and that he really stresses, is that he said it was by faith that Isaac blessed both his sons. What he said to Jacob was, you get the inheritance, you get the blessing, you get all of my property, you get all of my relatives as your servants. All of your mother's sons are going to serve you. You're going to be the head of the household. You get the birthright blessing, and you get the dew and the rain and the crops and the food. You get the best of everything. That's my blessing for you. And by faith, he said that about his son. And then he said to his son Esau, you're going to be away from the dew, and you're going to live in a tough land. You're going to have the sword in your hand, and you're going to be fighting all the time. And that's what I say about you. Then 1,500 years go by, Malachi's walking around the planet. Malachi goes to Israel. Israel's in rebellion against God. Malachi starts right out with, I've loved you. And you're going to say to me, how have I loved you? And my evidence is, I've loved you and blessed you, and look what I did to the Edomites. In other words, God did exactly according to the blessing that was handed out all the way back here. And history shows that God did to Israel and the Edomites exactly as the blessing was handed out back here. So the purpose of what the writer of Hebrews is saying is that when he did that, when he handed out those blessings, one of which was truly a blessing and one of which was more like a curse, that when he did that, he did it in faith, because that's the subject of Hebrews 11 collectively. So by faith, he handed out these prophecies over his sons, and then it turned out exactly the way he handed them out. Now, a little bit further, chapter 28. Jacob has a dream. He's departed from Beersheba. He went to Haran, verse 11 of chapter 28. He came to a certain place. He spent the night there because the sun had set. He took one of the stones from that place and he put it under his head and he laid down in that place. And he had a dream, and behold, a ladder was set up on the earth and its top reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give it to you and to your descendants. And so the very one whom God chose in the womb, the very one who got the birthright blessing through chicanery, is now being told by God that the Abrahamic covenant in toto now belongs to him. This is the seventh recitation of the Abrahamic covenant in the book of Genesis, and it's being specifically given to Jacob, because Jacob have I loved. Jacob I chose. Your descendants shall also be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread out to the west, and to the east, and to the north, and to the south. And in you and in your descendants shall all the families of the earth be blessed. And behold, I am with you, and I will keep you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. So, Abraham got that promise. Abraham had two sons. God chose the younger, rejected the older. So in Isaac shall thy seed be called. We saw it last week. Isaac was given that same promise. Isaac has twin children. God says in advance that the older is going to serve the younger. Now he gives that same promise, the Abrahamic covenant, to Jacob. The next important thing that happens to Jacob is that God does not leave him in that state. His name is Supplanter. His name is Heel Catcher. You know the story. He encounters an angel of God. He encounters him and he wrestles with him. And in the wrestling, he is asked, "What is your name?" And he has to admit, hold on, there. He has to admit to what his name is. He admits, "My name is Supplanter." Remember way back where Esau said, he's rightly named. He's a supplanter. He got the birthright blessing through his chicanery, through his lying and thievery, through his swindling. That's how he ended up getting it. But then God, who determined in the first place that the older was going to serve the younger, God then shows up and repeats the Abrahamic covenant to him. So he has the Abrahamic covenant completely, but God doesn't leave him like that. God doesn't give him the Abrahamic covenant. Promise, the land promise that through his descendants, all the families of the earth are going to be blessed. All of that, he gives him that, and then he says, "What's your name?" It's Jacob. And he says, "No longer is your name going to be called Jacob. You're going to be called Yisrael." Now, this El at the end of it, of course, is a name of God. And there have been plenty of commentaries and arguments about how to define the name Yisrael. The name Israel can be translated as God contended. Some people prefer that translation because, after all, there was a wrestling match involved, and God and Jacob did contend with each other that night. Some commentators say that actually it comes from a verb that means to be strong or to rule or to have authority, thereby making the name mean God rules or God judges. That also is a fair translation of it. And of course, the King James goes with the idea of a prince of God. And so the translation for many years was prince who has power with God. Putting more emphasis then on Jacob himself, saying that he's the prince that has power with God. As people have dug further into the name, as I said, there are translations that say the power, the judging, the authority is in God. The name might mean God who is the ruler, God who is the judge. I prefer to say all of that is wrapped up in the name. And God, very importantly, takes that one, that person, that Jacob, that heel catcher, that supplanter, and says, "I'm going to change your name. From now on, you're going to be known as Yisrael, the one who has contended with God, or the one who belongs to the God who has all the power, the God who is the judge." And all of his descendants from that point forward, just like the descendants of Abraham carry Abraham's name, or the descendants of Isaac carried Isaac's name, from that point forward, all his descendants carry the name of Israel. And that name hasn't changed. All these years later, there's still a nation over there in the Middle East called Israel. Every time you look at a world map, the name God who is a judge, God who is powerful, God who contends is right there on the map. God continues to say, "That land right there, that's my land. It has my name." Later, he's going to call the land that. He's going to say, "The place where I've placed my name." And for all these years, through all the wars and all the contentions and all the politics and all the efforts to erase God from our consciousness and from our planet and from our politics, God continues to place his name right there on the planet. "I'm the God who judges. I'm the God who's in charge. I am Yisrael." Isn't that interesting? So now, you know that Israel has his name changed just before he has his last child. And we'll get into that a little bit more next week. His last child is Benjamin, his youngest. And Joseph, as I already mentioned, had been sold into slavery and is in Egypt. And his brothers are going to ultimately stand in front of their brother. And then when he, Israel, Jacob, is old, he's going to see Joseph, who was his favorite son, the one that he loved the most. And Joseph's two sons are going to be brought in front of him. And it's going to be time for him to do what Isaac did for him. Isaac handed him the birthright. And now it's his turn to pass on the birthright. And that's where we're going to pick up next week. And we're going to see that pattern continue yet again, where the younger is going to end up with the birthright as God continues to pick and choose the direction that the seed is going to flow, ultimately leading to Christ. The reason they did this was because they had faith in what God said. That's the point of this entire chapter. Once God has said it, it is true. You can count on it, and it's going to come about. It's going to happen. So then he's going to go on to Moses, and then he's just going to keep going. And he's going to say, all these did all this by faith and died without having received the promise. We're nearly there. We're getting there. We'll be done with chapter 11 in 2, maybe 3 weeks. Don't you laugh at me. We're getting there. We're working our way toward it. But I think we'd be doing a disservice to the text if we just read the two lines that the writer of Hebrews wrote about Jacob and Esau and didn't go back and look at the whole story and understand his perspective, because he knew all this about that relationship and about how God dealt with Jacob and Esau through history and the curse that was in Malachi and Paul's use of it as proof of sovereign election. It's a really, really important element in God's history that today still resonates, not just geopolitically, not just because Israel still exists as a nation, but also because still today God is picking and choosing. God is still electing. Election by sovereign grace is still active. And to this day, the God who said, I choose Jacob and I reject Esau, Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated, is to this very day saying, Tom I chose, Tim I chose, and Jamie I chose. To this very day, he's still picking and choosing his people. He's still saying to them, regardless of what age they are. Some are young, like Christian, who we just baptized. Some are slightly older, like Miss Gladys. But God is still in the process of picking and choosing and calling out his people. And he proved that all the way back at Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated, two babies in a womb. Same God, same activity, still the same, still doing it. And I teach that and teach that and teach that, not because I'm a Calvinist, but because that's exactly what the Bible says. Got it?
Got it.
Questions about that? Yes, ma'am.
All right. God spoke about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the womb.
Mm-hmm.
And we know it's come to pass. We know what Malachi said about him. Also in Malachi it says, all nations will call you blessed, for you will be a delightful land.
And we're still kind of waiting for that, aren't we? Yeah. At the moment, I don't think all the nations call Israel blessed.
I don't think they ever have.
No, I don't think they ever have. But they will. Because every knee is going to bow. And every tongue is going to confess that Jesus is Lord. I mean, there are certain things that God has said are going to happen. Are going to happen. I don't know what's wrong with my tongue today. There are certain things that are, I just suddenly became, there are certain things that are going to happen. There are certain things that are just going to happen because God said so. And so they have to. And that's one of them. All nations are going to call Israel blessed. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Could you say something about, but it's when Isaac is blessing Esau, he says here, but it shall come about when you become restless, meaning Esau,
mm-hmm.
right, or his
right.
people.
Right, Esau, yeah.
That you shall break his, meaning the yoke, the grudge he holds because his mm-hmm. brother got the blessing and he didn't. And you will break his yoke from your neck.
Mm-hmm.
What is it?
Whenever you read yoke, especially in the Old Testament, that yoke of bondage, Paul uses that language too in talking about the law, how it's a yoke of bondage. historically, that's what Esau did. Rather than serve his brother, which is what he was supposed to do, stay there and serve, eventually he just left and said, you're not going to rule over me anymore. I'm going to do my own thing. And he took off. And that's what that's referring to. And then eventually they do make a peace between them. And it happens because Jacob starts just sending out animals and people ahead of him when they're about to meet each other. And they've both at that point become great people groups and, you know, large families. And Jacob's afraid that his brother's going to kill him. So he just starts sending gifts and gifts and gifts. And fortunately, Esau shows up and says, I've got plenty. I don't need yours. I'm okay. And they go their separate ways. And the Edomites through the rest of the Old Testament are a thorn in Israel's side. So he broke off the rule that said that all of the brothers were all going to serve the younger. We're going to serve Jacob. He broke that yoke and said, no, I'm not going to be in bondage to you. I'm not going to be. And he took his things and his people and he left.
We thank you for joining us for this Salvation by Grace message. For more information, please visit our website at salvationbygrace.org. And join us next time as we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.